We're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you for those who are here on time. I'm going to open up with Psalm 25. This was our psalm this morning for our family. And it was, I don't know if you could even imagine this, but it was just slightly chaotic this morning in our house. And we never finished the psalm. So I'll finish it with you this morning. Wherever you're at, from this past week, whatever's happened, just hear this psalm as God's word to you and your word back to God. Psalm 25, one of my favorites. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. But make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day long. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been from of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in the way. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. Hear this verse, one of my all-time favorites. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his covenant and his testimonies. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my guilt, for it is great. Who's the man who fears the Lord? Him he will instruct in the way that he should choose. His soul shall abide in well-being, and his offspring shall inherit the land. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him. And he makes known to them his covenant. My eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I'm lonely and afflicted. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. Bring me out of my distresses. Consider my affliction and my trouble and forgive all my sins. Consider how many are my foes and with what violent hatred they hate me. Oh, guard my soul and deliver me. Let me not be put to shame, for I take refuge in you. May integrity and uprightness preserve me, for I wait for you. Redeem Israel, O God, out of all his troubles. And yes, O God, we affirm all that the psalm says this morning. No matter what we have faced this week, all the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness. You will instruct those who fear you. Your friendship is poured out on those who fear your name. In the midst of historical facts, let these words just breathe life into us today. In the name of the risen Messiah King, we pray. Amen. Psalm 25. Well worth your diligent memorizing. All right. I've been asking this every week. And not that I'm disappointed, but not once has somebody gotten all five areas correct yet. So I'm looking for somebody today who can tell me the five major geographical divisions of Israel, the five major geographical divisions of Israel. Is there anybody who can be bribed to tell me that? Rick?
The coast, the Galilean Judean hills, the Jordan Rift or Jordan Valley, the Transjordan Plateau, and the Jezreel Valley.
Right. Good job, Rick. So Rick is going to get What is the Lord's Supper by R.C. Sproul?
Whoa.
And A Time for Confidence, Trusting God in a Post-Christian Society by Stephen Nichols. Great little book there. Thank you. Now, which of those five areas have I argued, historically speaking, is the most important geographical zone in terms of just how it affects geopolitics, you could say? Jezreel Valley, that's right. Somebody want an extra map, a new map that doesn't have one? Okay. You can thank Glenn Lampkin for that. All right, any questions from last week? Anything that was fuzzy, unsure about? Okay, you now know the Jezreel Valley. That's good. You know, there was like a chorus of Jezreel Valley when you said that. That was great. All right, let's see if this thing will work. We are marching on today. There's your map. See again. So the coast, the hills and the mountain zone, the Rift Valley, lowest place on earth, Transjordanian, and I'm clicking too far here, and then the Jezreel Valley. Again, remember, pay so close attention, particularly in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel, to when those towns that show up, and look and see how often they're up in this region. Things are discussed and what's going on there, especially when foreign powers are involved with that. So we have finished the pre-Israel period or the Canaanite period that we've talked about. Who can tell me, just maybe throw out a couple essential things to know about this period that we've talked about? What are just some essential big picture key things to remember about this big thousand-year period? Anything. Take a stab at it. Yes. Yeah, good. Egypt ruled everything in Canaan. They were in charge. They were the superpower of that land. What else strikes you that you remember from that time? Will? The worldwide dark age. That's right. Does anybody remember when that began, roughly? What's that? Yeah, that works. 1200 BC. In 1200, there's this magnificent collapse of the entire world. Everything from Greece all the way around the Mediterranean basin, all the way down, everything collapses off into Mesopotamia. It collapses, and it... What was significant about that? Does anybody remember? How did that affect Canaan and Israel and those things?
Huh? Canaan, instead of the Egyptians ruling with an iron fist and being able to protect it, they drew back, and that allowed Canaan to be kind of like no man's land, that these little kingdoms popped up that were weak.
That's right.
Which allowed the Israelites, when they marched into Canaan, that they're not dealing with the Egyptian army.
That's right. Exactly right. So if you heard that, Tom said that essentially when these superpowers are collapsing, Egypt withdraws from Canaan, though there's evidence that they were desperate to kind of show the world that, hey, we actually still have Canaan, but everybody knew they didn't. And what that did was that caused a power vacuum to open up. and allowed for all these little nations to kind of pop up, these little city-state nations, including the Israelites and including the Philistines, the Phoenicians, these other groups that are kind of in this region, the Moabites, the Edomites. They all kind of begin being able to thrive a little bit on their own rather than under the thumb of the Egyptians because of this collapse that happened. Okay, we'll go on here. So we entered into the United Monarch, 1932. Again, just this really, really short period, very tiny period with David and Solomon. David establishes his kingdom. We didn't talk so much about this, but David really began in Hebron, which Hebron, if you looked at your map, I don't think it's on that map there, but the Hebron's in the Judean hills in the south there. And his territory, if you read the text closely, you'll see that his territory was just this little bubble in the Judean hills. And then when he united the kingdom, he moved the capital to Jerusalem to bring it closer to the northern tribes. And then there's all these kinds of debates of how much he really ruled. It seems like he kind of subjected territories around him. And that brings us then to Solomon and Solomon's rule. You can see here on the map, on this map, this is typically what some will say Solomon's rule was. Here's the Euphrates River, all the way up here, Palmyra, you might have heard of. Then down here, this is modern Israel in green, right here. So this is ancient Edom, Moab, Ammon, Aram. Often people will argue that this was his kingdom. And rightly so, the Bible talks about how he extended kind of rule up there. This comes, though, you have to remember a few things. This comes in the wake of the international crisis, of the collapse of all these nations. This is still the echo of that kind of going out. And so Solomon's able to kind of subjugate farther out than normally he would be able to. But there's one thing I want to look at. If you turn with me, if you want to 1 Kings 4:21, this is where most will go to argue the extent of his kingdom. 1 Kings 4:21. Begin at verse 20. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now, there's something that we need to keep in mind here, though, that the author is doing. When the author says that he ruled from the Euphrates to the border of Egypt, down here, this entire tract of land, what is this tract of land? What have we talked about in terms of if we zoomed out to the entire ancient world picture? What did I call that tract of land? Anybody remember? The whole thing is the Fertile Crescent coming from Babylon over. But what is this little strip of land called? Somebody said it. The land bridge. This is the land bridge. What the writer of Kings is doing, I would argue, is he's simply saying, This is an idiom for he had rule over the land bridge. Not meaning literally from our historical viewpoint that he actually had armies up at the Euphrates River controlling everything. No. As we read later in Kings, what we see is that Solomon controlled was the international road through Israel. And the best way to say that in the ancient world was to say he ruled from Egypt to Euphrates. And what they mean by that, and I could show, if we had time, I could show you from other ancient literature, what they mean by that is that Solomon controlled the trade route as it came through Israel. And as a result, the author is saying he ruled the land bridge. He ruled from Egypt to the Euphrates. And the reason why I bring this up is because a lot of people will look at this and will say, well, the Bible's wrong. Now, obviously, the Bible's in error here. We know the Bible's in error here because we have all sorts of texts to show that Aram, as well as the Philistines and Edom and Moab, were their own independent territories. And they controlled all sorts of other things. So the Bible's wrong here, people would argue. But that's not quite right. That is treating the Bible like a history book that I warned you about. Because that's not what the author is saying here. What the author is saying is that Solomon ruled the international trade route, so therefore he ruled from Egypt to the Euphrates. Anybody, any ancient Israelite reading this would have got that. That Solomon had influence throughout this territory because of that. These nations, if you think about this, look at his alliances. These nations made alliances with Solomon because of this trade route. They wanted to make sure that they could tap into it and that they could access it. And so they have to make sure they're friends with Solomon. On the other hand, Solomon, remember where his territory is. His territory, strictly speaking, and in fact, the text goes on to say, yeah, look at verse 25 in this text, and Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba. That's actually where they ruled. The text even says that. So from Dan, right here, to Beersheba. He ruled this little strip, which is the Judean hillside zone that I talked about. And as a result, if that's what he rules, and he wants to have influence in the world, he needs to make what? Treaties and alliances. That theologically, the Bible comes and says, these were not good for him in 1 Kings 11. And they say that these alliances actually led Solomon astray because he started linking arms with all these guys in the pursuit of more and more wealth and the pursuit of more and more power and territory, and it ultimately destroyed him. So 1 Kings 4:21, I'd argue, is an idiom for a land bridge, meaning he accesses the land bridge, and everybody has to go through his territory that he rules to use that. And theologically, the author in 1 Kings is really just trying to show how God is establishing his kingdom and expanding the influence of his people in that way. But with Solomon, there's trouble on the horizon. Now, this is actually not true right here. And why is this picture here not true about ancient Israel? What's that? Were there sharks in Israel? Israel had no access to water, remember? Okay, that's just a minor thing. Land sharks. 1 Kings 11. Trouble arises in 1 Kings 11. Beginning in verse 26. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite of Zeredah, a servant of Solomon. Now, notice he's an Ephraimite. Where's Ephraim? It's more north. Remember that. Whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also lifted up his hand against the king. And this was the reason why he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built the Milo, which we don't know where that is, and closed up the breach of the city of David, his father. The man Jeroboam was very able, and when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor at the house of Joseph. And at the time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. And you have this whole discourse about how you're going to get part of this kingdom because I'm going to punish Solomon. And he goes on. Then farther down, after he gives this indictment over Solomon, down verse 39, I will afflict the offspring of David because of this, but not forever. Then verse 40, now watch this. Solomon sought, therefore, to kill Jeroboam. But Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt, to Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. The writer is trying to tell you there is trouble on the horizon. There is trouble coming. Watch out what's going to happen. And we know, as we work into the divided kingdom, you probably know from 1 Kings 12 that you have this whole spat between Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and then Jeroboam returns, and he comes back. And it causes this whole friction, and the kingdom splits. And what I think is happening is that this is actually, this is Egypt's attempt to gain power again in Canaan. Jeroboam is a puppet of Egypt. He's a puppet king. And one reason we know that is if you look in 1 Kings 14, verse 25, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the shields of gold that Solomon had made. And it goes on. Right during this split, Shishak comes up into Jerusalem. And I would argue brings Jeroboam with him and sets him up in the northern kingdom. And we actually have evidence of there's a stele piece, a big monument that was left at Megiddo in the northern kingdom that Shishak left there saying, hey guys, I'm back. I'm in charge again. But he worked through Jeroboam to do that. Now, as the story plays out, Egypt is almost laughable trying to do this because they immediately just shrink again. And they just can't continue the power that they once had, though Shishak was trying through Jeroboam to establish that. So that's kind of politically behind the scenes what's going on with the divided kingdom in terms of how Jeroboam comes into play to bring about this split. So when we come to the entire divided monarch here, we're talking a period of about 346 years of the whole kingdom. Again, relatively a small period. Biblically, we're talking about 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles, and then we're talking about 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles in terms of the timeline. We're also talking about the period of the prophets. Think of guys like Amos, Hosea, Isaiah. With Isaiah is also Micah. And then that's kind of the end. That's the end of the northern kingdom. Then you move into the southern kingdom, Habakkuk and Zephaniah and Jeremiah. And of course, there's others I'm not mentioning here. So this is now the period that we're moving into and thinking about, which is the divided monarch. So when we think about the divided monarch, here's a pretty good map. We have Judah down here in the south. Again, note the Philistines have all this power up here. This map's not quite accurate. The Philistines also pushed all the way up here in this region here. Then we have the northern kingdom, Israel here, called Israel. And this territory and this territory, as we'll see, was always contested. Often there was a line right here, and they actually weren't over in this region, and they weren't over in this region. This entire area was kind of always contested, as I'll show here. We have these regional powers. We have Philistia there. We have Ammon, which, again, this map has Ammon right here, but really Ammon pushed all the way over here and down here and up here at times. We have Moab, you can see. We have Edom is down here to the southeast of Judah. And we have Israel there in the north, and we have Judah. These are the kind of the regional power players. These are the small territory states around this area. Constant wars going on. Constant territory being gained and lost between these groups. These groups were always fighting. And we see this both in the archaeological record, and we see this in the biblical textual record. Then we have intermediate powers during this whole period. Again, I'm just talking about the entire divided kingdom period. We have Syria, Aram up in the north. Everything really from the Sea of Galilee, northeast, that direction. Syria controlled this entire region to the Euphrates River. We have Egypt to the southwest here in this area. Egypt also typically controlled mining rights in this area, though when Israel was strong enough, or Judah was strong enough, Judah would push into here, or when Edom, which is right here, Edom was strong enough, Edom would push into here and control that area. Then we have the final intermediate power. These are not superpowers. And again, note, Egypt is no longer a superpower. They never became a superpower ever again after the collapse of 1200. Never again did they have that magnificent kingdom. You have Phoenicia, which is Sidon and Tyre right here along the coast. And if we had time, we'd talk a lot more about the Phoenicians. They're fascinating group of people, and we have a whole bunch of texts that they left behind, so we know a lot about them. They're probably most famously known popularly for a town by the name of, anybody know the name? What's that? But they migrated a group of people to a certain town. Carthage, yes, to Carthage. And we know, the archaeologically speaking, at this period, the people in Carthage were certainly Phoenicians. Phoenicia was incredibly important in the ancient world during this period because of them being right on the coast, and they were, unlike Philistia and Israel or Judah, they had natural harbors, multiple natural harbors. And so everybody wanted to be friends with the Phoenicians because of their ability to go out into the Mediterranean and do trade all over the Mediterranean. Now think about that. Think about who did Solomon make friends with in order to build the temple? Anybody remember? Say it loud. Yes, Hiram, the king of Tyre. And he's reaching out to him because Solomon can't get wood for the temple. He needs somebody who has mountains and somebody who has boats to transport things. Similarly, think about the northern kingdom, and the northern kingdom, their entire existence, they struggled with the worship of Baal, remember? And does anybody remember who did that come through? Her name is Jezebel. Jezebel, the queen of Ahab, and she was the daughter of a Phoenician king. And so again, you have this kind of linking coming together for trade reasons that pollutes Israel and destroys them ultimately. Now, as I mentioned, during this entire period, there's constant regional wars going on. You first have up here Aram, and all the way up the map, see up there, there's the Euphrates. You have Aram always fighting for this territory all through here, from the Galilee north and east and south down in this region. Constant battles. You can look at 1 Kings 20 for a good example of war going on. You have all these conflicts going on, and a lot of important artifacts have come out of these wars that we have, including this beautiful gem that we have found at Tel Dan, right here. And it was found in this location right here. This is the gate of Tel Dan going in, and it was found out here. And the reason why this inscription is so important is that it records the earliest instance of the mention outside of the Bible of David. This is the king of Aram speaking. "I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziahu, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. And I made their towns into ruins and turned their land into," and it goes on. Right here, you can see it's in white. This is the house of David. And this is actually recorded in 2 Kings chapter 9 and 10, in which Jehu rises up and he overthrows the house of Ahab. The king of Aram takes credit for it in this inscription. In 2 Kings 9 and 10, there's no mention of that. But that's because the Bible was focusing in on Jehu about this. But we know from this inscription that almost guaranteed Jehu was actually a puppet of Aram. And so Aram sets up this steel to take credit for this and say, "Hey, I beat up those Israelites." And in that course, he happens to mention the house of David. Another war zone was with Moab down here during this period. Moab and the northern kingdom was always fighting over this stretch of land. And there's a number of biblical texts that you can see that. But there's also a nice stele, an entire stele that was found in Jordan, in which it describes also these wars going on. Here's what some of the text says. "I am Mesha, son of Chemosheite, king of Moab." If you look at 2 Kings 3, this very king shows up, Mesha, in the text, talking probably about some of these same events. He goes on at another point, "I built this high place for Chemosh." Chemosh, maybe you're familiar with that name. He's the Moabite god. "Because he saved me. Omri," who is Omri? What famous son did he have? Anybody know? Who said that? Ahab. Omri was the father of the Ahab king that everybody hates. "Omri was king of Israel, and he oppressed Moab many days. And his son said, 'I will oppress Moab.' In my days, he spoke thus, 'But I was victorious over him and his house, and Israel suffered everlasting destruction.'" Did they suffer everlasting destruction? No, they didn't. But that's how you said in the ancient world that you beat those guys. Think about that when you're reading the biblical text, when they say, we destroyed such and such, everlasting forever and ever, they were no more. Don't read it as a modern American. This is how they talk. This is how they think about the ancient warfare going on. Judy?
These old names are hard to pronounce. What helps me was Omri. If you translate it into English, it's like Omri. Carthage. If anybody who's lived their whole life in Cincinnati, like my dad, he'll be 90. Is where the main, all the trains went through that went down to the river originally. It was the trade center of the Midwest.
And Carthage was the same way in ancient times. It was a major trade center. Thank you. Let's move on. Here, we have these regional wars that go on, but in the midst of these regional wars, behind the scenes, there was a much greater threat brewing at the same time. That was partly why all these regional wars were going on, people vying for control of certain pieces. And that is because of these people. The Assyrians. Very far away from ancient Israel, seldom thought of during the time of David, during the time of Solomon. But during the divided kingdom, suddenly people kept thinking more and more about the Assyrians. Now, Assyria had a pretty significant kingdom during the late Bronze Age, which is the period we talked about previously. But just like all the other superpowers, Assyria fell apart. Assyria was the one that I had mentioned who wrote this letter to the Hittite king and said, "Hey, I'm a great king now." And the Hittite king, if you remember, wrote back and kind of said, "Who are you writing me?" But they were a significant kingdom. And at the late Bronze Age collapse, they too fell apart and shrunk down to just this little region right here along, this is the Tigris River. Here's the Euphrates going along here. Here's the Tigris. The star here, it's kind of dark on the screen. If you can see right there, that's Nineveh, ancient Nineveh. And during the 10th century and then into the 9th century, Assyria began to expand again, began slowly growing outward. This is during the period of Omri and Ahab and Jehu and Jehoshaphat, if you think about these guys in the Bible. Assyria begins to expand out, and they don't go south first, though they like to beat up Babylon. Their primary interest was to go west. Why do you think they wanted to keep going west? Any ideas? To the sea. That's right. To the sea. Everybody wanted the sea. If you get to the sea, you can control the world. You can have access to ports. You can get across the Mediterranean. And so they're pushing their way along the Euphrates River throughout the 9th century. A climactic event comes then in 853 at a little town called Karkar, right about there on this map. North, so this is Karkar, this is Syria, ancient Syria. Phoenicia is down here, and this is kind of the realm of Syria out in here. In 853, an Assyrian king by the name of Shalmaneser III rose up, and he decided it was time that the Assyrians take control of the ports on the Mediterranean. Well, this caused a lot of concern amongst Ahab and his friends around the northern kingdom area. And they decided that they were going to come up and confront Shalmaneser. So Shalmaneser's coming across here. On his way, he's beating up all these towns along here. Then he hits Aleppo and he comes down. And waiting for him at Karkar are all these groups of people in the Levant. Aram organized it. Ahab joined in on it. And they all come up. Byblos, these are the Phoenicians down here. Byblos, Sidon, Tyre. They all come up here and they meet him in this kind of cataclysmic battle that happens. And Shalmaneser leaves a record behind describing this battle. This is not in the Bible, but he leaves a record. And he goes through and talks about the coalition of the people from the southern Levant who fight. And in that he includes Ahab the Israelite came up and fought. It seems like they kind of stopped Assyria. Assyria did not progress and come down. Instead, Assyria kind of withdraws and comes back. Yet, we also know at this very period that all these kings came under submission to the Assyrians. So what happened at the battle, something must have happened that they kind of mutually agreed it would be best for them to send tribute to Assyria, including this guy right here, bowing down to the Assyrian king, Shalmaneser III here. The guy there that you're looking at is Jehu, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel. This is the only depiction of an Israelite king in any iconography like this anywhere in the world found. That we know for a fact that this is Jehu, the king of Israel. Here's what the text says. The tribute of Jehu, son of Omri. I received from him silver, gold, a golden saplu bowl, a golden vase with pointed bottom, and it goes on. I'm not going to read through the whole thing. Shalmaneser is describing the tribute that Jehu brings to him. So we know at this point that the Israelites were in submission to Assyria. Assyria used the Israelites during the United Kingdom kind of as a proxy kingdom. You've never seen that happen before, have you? Think about today and just even modern politics in the Middle East. These nations setting up kind of proxies for their own interests and things like that. Jehu becomes that for Assyria in the northern kingdom. And if you read through 1st, 2nd Kings carefully, you will see how there's kind of almost this sense that somebody else is pulling the strings behind events at times. Yes, it's ultimately Yahweh, just to be clear. But Assyria is on the march and kind of beginning to encroach and push in their influence. Now, at the same time this is going on, Assyria also is having internal problems. And they begin to kind of withdraw. And this opens up a space for the Israelites to begin kind of self-ruling themselves a little bit more easily. And you have the period of Jeroboam II, which is 792 to about 756 or so, somewhere in that time period we're now looking at. Jeroboam II was the king during the prophecies of Amos, and Amos critiques Jeroboam II for being so lavish and so just taking advantage of everybody. And one reason, though, is he was able to keep more money for himself because Assyria wasn't draining the coffers because they were kind of shrinking in power at that point. But Assyria returns. They After about 75 years of shrinking a little bit, they come back to the northern kingdom knocking on their door. And this begins the reign of Tiglath-Pileser III, who is mentioned in the Bible. In 745, his reign begins. And his reign takes the world by storm. It's as if the Assyrian Empire just suddenly explodes outward. They're kind of just in this region, and they had some influence along this path to the Mediterranean, but during Tiglath-Pileser, suddenly he just pushes out every direction imaginable and creates this massive empire suddenly. Suddenly Assyria, for the first time since 1200 BC, for the first time, a superpower arises in the ancient world, and that is Assyria. He first takes out Babylonia down this area. He pushes up into Urat, or on this map it says Ararat, the source areas of the Tigris River, further up north. He pushes into what formerly years and years and years ago would have been the Hittite Empire. They still kind of called them the Hittites, though they were not the Hittites. And then from about 743 to 739, 738, he decides that it's time to take the land bridge. It's time to push down and see what he can do. And so he begins pushing down, and he takes out all of Syria, and he's right at the borders of the northern kingdom of Israel. It's at this point that the northern king of Israel makes an alliance with a number of people and tries to push back on Assyria. Well, guess who decides not to make an alliance with the northern king and push back on Assyria? A man by the name of Ahaz. Ahaz, think Isaiah chapter 7 and chapter 8. This famous passage of the virgin shall give birth. That is all in the context of these events right here. Ahaz in Judah, he's in Judah, and he sees the Assyrian threat, and he sees his northern neighbors trying to push Assyria back and demanding that he joins their coalition. Well, Ahaz is warned by Isaiah, don't make a treaty with these guys, with Assyria. Join this coalition. Well, Ahaz makes a treaty with Assyria instead. And because of that, the northern kingdom comes down and beats Judah up a little bit. But then Tiglath-Pileser, he decides, I've had enough, and he's about ready to invade Assyria, or invade the northern kingdom, and he dies. So then his son rises up, has a few internal problems, and then decides to finish off his daddy's problem, the northern kingdom, who was trying to keep Assyria from coming any farther down toward Egypt, which was their goal. Their goal was to get to Egypt. They could care less about the northern kingdom. They could care less about Judah. They wanted to get to Egypt to control the entire land bridge. So in 722, I know there's a lot of dates. Don't worry about the dates. In 722, a guy by the name of Shalmaneser V, he pushes down and takes out the northern kingdom. 2 Kings chapter 15 and 16, and 2 Kings chapter 17. Shalmaneser V, and then the next king, Sargon II, kind of takes credit for what Shalmaneser did, even though Sargon really didn't do it. And they beat up the northern kingdom, and they destroy the northern kingdom, and they exile everybody out of the northern kingdom. in the northern kingdom is never heard from again because of that. We have a bit of evidence outside of the Bible of this. This is Sargon saying, I surrounded and deported as prisoners 27,290 of Samaria's inhabitants, together with their chariots and the gods in whom they trusted. From them I equipped 200 chariots, while the rest I made to take up their residence within Assyria. I restored the city of Samaria. I brought into it people from the countries conquered by my own hands. This fits exactly with 2 Kings chapter 17 and what's going on there. It's a great example of these ancient texts just complementing, filling out better for us the picture of what's going on. And of course, from a biblical standpoint, the biblical writers focused on the idolatry of the northern kingdom. And in the book of Isaiah, essentially says that God whistled and Assyria came. And that Assyria was working for Yahweh. So the northern kingdom destroyed. So we think about the kingdom. Think about this kingdom that existed for 200 years. They had 19 kings. And more importantly, they had 9 dynasties. Meaning, 9 different times the northern kingdom changed whatever family was actually ruling. What does that tell you about the northern kingdom? What's that? Unstable. You know, in contrast, the Judean kingdom survived for 350 years and had 1 dynasty. So God's condemnation over the northern kingdom certainly came about. So they fall to Assyria in 722 as Assyria pushes down. Incidentally, in 722, they skip attacking Judah, but they do attack Philistia, and they skip Judah because of Ahaz. Because Ahaz made this treaty with Assyria. And Ahaz thinks, I'm going to be okay. Northern refugees flee to Judah. Those who were able to escape, others were slaughtered and killed or deported. And what this did, though, was it left, even though Ahaz kind of had this treaty going on, the people, it left the people trembling, including Hezekiah, who was the king of Judah at this point. It left them utterly trembling. Isaiah, I think it's Isaiah 5. Isaiah 5, 26 gives this great description, probably of the Assyrian army. Doesn't say it explicitly, but almost guaranteed this is the Assyrian army. He will raise a signal for nations far away. This is Yahweh. He will raise a signal for nations far away and whistle for them from the ends of the earth. And behold, quickly, speedily they come. None is weary. Now he's talking about the army. None is weary. None stumbles. None slumbers or sleeps. Not a waistband is loose. Not a sandal strap broken. Their arrows are sharp. All their bows bent. Their horses' hooves seem like flint. And their wheels like the whirlwind. Their roaring is like a lion. The symbol of Assyria was the lion. Like young lions they roar. They growl and seize their prey. They carry it off and none can rescue. It's like my little lions at home. They will growl over it on that day, like the growling of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and distress. And the light is darkened by its clouds. The Judeans had very good reason to fear the Assyrians. A few years before these events, one Assyrian king said this, I captured many troops alive. I cut off of some their arms and hands. I cut off of others their noses, ears, and extremities. I gouged out the eyes of many troops. I made one pile of the living and one of their heads. I hung the heads on trees around the city. Are you feeling good right now about the Assyrians? Here's the same guy who wrote this. Here's some iconography from him. Here he, it's kind of hard to see. Here he is lounging on a chair. He's sipping some tea. and he's eating food. Here's his wife. And directly across, he's looking at these trees here. And look right here. There's a lovely little head hanging from the tree. A sign that this is propaganda, okay? This is propaganda. This is meant to send a signal. Don't mess with me. And this signal is just going out to Judah and to Hezekiah and to others around. This just constant sign of this siren just going off in Judah as they're thinking about stuff like this. That could be me, Hezekiah's thinking. So Hezekiah prepares because he knows Assyria at some point is going to want to push farther. And so he begins to prepare, and he prepares for the next king by the name of Sennacherib. And you can read about this in 2 Kings 18 through 19. And Hezekiah makes all these preparations. This is the infamous Hezekiah's tunnel that the Israel team walked through, through the water there. And he made this tunnel going from a spring on the outside of the city and came into the city to protect the water. And he brought the water in so people didn't have to go outside of the city. This is described in the Bible and how he built this. And it's fascinating to walk through. He also expanded Jerusalem, probably to encompass the fleeing refugees of the northern kingdom. And he built this massive wall that has now been uncovered. The Bible talks about him building it, and we've uncovered it. Not me, you know, though I imagine I was there. Here's his, it's called the Broad Wall here, found in the old city today. And you can see a map here. Here's what he does. This right here is the city of David. This was David's Jerusalem. David's Jerusalem was tiny. It was tiny. Think little village. Don't think seat of an empire, okay? Very tiny. Solomon expanded it slightly with the Temple Mount right here. Several hundred years later, Hezekiah comes along, and he's trying to think how to protect his people and how to protect from these coming Assyrians, and he builds this massive wall coming way out here around to protect, because for all sorts of, we don't have time to get into it, but all sorts of geographical reasons, this is probably the direction the Assyrians would come from, he knew, and not from this direction because of steep valleys and cliffs and things down here. So he expands the walls, and he prepares for the coming of the Assyrians. And they come, don't they? They come and they march. Sennacherib marches, and 2 Kings 18:19 talks about some of this. He comes from the north. He comes down and he beats up Phoenicia. And he comes down and he takes out the Philistines. And you know Hezekiah is getting reports about this all the way. You know he's getting these reports of, well, Philistines just fell. The Phoenicians fell. And he's moving closer. And just down here, after he takes out the last Philistine area, he turns in to get to the Judeans, because he couldn't come from this direction. He can't come straight down because of the geography. He comes from the side and comes down, and he lands at Lachish. And then he heads toward Jerusalem. 2 Kings here. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I've done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. And if you know the story in 2 Kings 18, 19, you have this dramatic story in which God rescues Jerusalem and preserves Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib. But the rest of the country doesn't go so well for them. Judah is devastated. He even leaves, Sennacherib leaves all these pictures of the wars at Lachish, which was the Judean fort that was kind of the entranceway to Jerusalem. If you look back here, if he took out Lachish, there was a valley path that he could get up through to get to Jerusalem. And so he encamps at Lachish, and he's headed toward Jerusalem. And his defeat of Lachish is described at Nineveh in these huge portraits. It would fill this whole room, 55 panels. It would go all the way around describing the story. So this is Lachish right here. These are the Judeans, and these are the Assyrians. Look how they're bigger than the Judeans. They're fighting them, siege warfare. I'll just show a few more. These are Judeans being carried off in exile. Here's Judeans. The things didn't go so well for them. Right there. This is what the Bible means by being hung. It's kind of hard to see it on this picture. You can see a little better here. The way you hung somebody in the ancient world is you put them straight down on something sharp and ran it all the way through their head. That's what hanging is. And the reason why I say this is this is the propaganda. This is the fear of the Judeans that they know they're facing, that's coming. This is no small event in the Bible. This is a cataclysmic disaster for them. And these pictures hung up in Nineveh, when the Judean representative has to go to Nineveh and give his tribute and taxes, he was forced to walk through this very room. And it was kind of this vivid reminder, don't revolt or else this will happen. The Bible's kind of tweak of that is God saying, don't harden your heart in unrepentance or this will happen, and I'll bring Assyria. I know we're out of time here, but let me just finish briefly here. This is the siege ramp of Lachish. Huge siege ramp that's still left archaeologically of them taking out the Lachish. So the Jerusalem siege happens, and the biblical narrative kind of focuses on how Yahweh dramatically rescues Jerusalem, which he does. It's an incredible story. But the land was devastated. There were 46 fortified towns in Judah wiped out. We know this archaeologically speaking, and Sennacherib writes about it. At least 10,000 Judeans were killed or deported. Judah was never the same again because of this event. It crippled them. It crippled their ability to ever thrive again. And this is also why there was this long biblical tradition of seeing the Assyrians as the most hateful, venge-filled people that the Bible condemns. Here's how Isaiah reflects on this. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, foreigners devour before you. It is desolate, as overthrown by foreigners. And daughter Zion, that is Jerusalem, is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a shelter in a cucumber field, like a besieged city, meaning only Jerusalem survived this assault. Biblically arguing that Yahweh's presence remained and he protected it. But as we're going to see next week, not for long. So at this point, there's a whole new world that opens up. For the first time in the ancient world since the collapse in 1200, there's a superpower that has gained control of the world, and that's Assyria. And you can see all the green. By 671, Assyria had this entire region of the ancient East. They ruled everything. And there's Judah right there. So after Hezekiah, think, when you're reading these biblical narratives, everything after Hezekiah is this picture right here. Assyria owns everything. Remember that when you're reading the biblical text, especially when you read like Manasseh, about what things that Manasseh does. All these kings are trying to figure out how to navigate this new world that they're living in. So much more to say, but we'll leave it at that. We're out of time. Let me pray for you and you can be dismissed. Father, let us not forget what you have to say to your people through 1st and 2nd Kings, particularly here, that this call of repentance is strong, and that those who harden their hearts end up like Lachish. So as we go to worship, and as we're led in the prayer of confession at worship, bring us to acknowledge our hearts and to be soft toward you and to be in right relationship with each other. It's in the name of Jesus we pray these things. Amen.